Right, the epoxy, right?
Yeah.
Well, I'm only going to use epoxy because it gives you the organization. There probably was 5, 6, or 7 cities in Laos where aid had permanent people stationed.
And I've heard epoxy a lot.
Well, epoxy was one of the larger. In epoxy, for example, there would have been a person from the agricultural department, maybe even 2 of them.
Uh-huh.
Been somebody from that supported the Lao public works people. That was different than our public works. Our public works didn't directly deal with the Lao highway department. There'd be somebody from the medical side of things. There'd be somebody on the refugee side of things. There'd be an aid person on community development. And they would fan out and support the IDS people who were in the more remote clusters.
Uh-huh.
And sometimes they'd go by air, sometimes by heat, and sometimes not at all.
Okay.
So I worked in epoxy, and when my time in IBS was up, I just continued working there, except then I became the public works person.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in that certain case, there were 4 or 5 other public works aid people there because they were building roads and highways, roads and airfields.
Mm-hmm.
So they needed more heavier duty people. What I did, I mostly supported the IBS people. And any of these things, call force accounts, schools.
Yeah.
Everybody compromises, I guess.
Yeah, well. Did you ever work with, you mentioned, the different places that you were with.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was while you were with IBS or later with AID,
mm-hmm.
working with the mom.
Later with AID, I worked on a road that linked the Hmong back to the lowland Lao.
Ah, okay.
So it was really, I'm going to say it was a military highway, but it really was a commercial link from the lowland, from the Mekong up into the hills.
Uh-huh.
You know Long Chan? You know the word Long Chan? You know Secret War in Laos?
Oh, yeah.
That's the place.
Yeah.
So we built the road through the real tough terrain.
Mm-hmm.
And I say I was just a small part of it. That road job had, I think, 3 camps.
Mm.
That so is big. Yeah, working on it simultaneously.
Mm-hmm. Is that when you got to meet Buell?
Yes. I didn't know Buell very well.
I met him
incidentally.
Right.
He flew in his own airplane, you know. But it was his operation that this road supported.
Right. That's why I thought you would have at least met him.
Well, of course, by then there were a lot of other Americans doing a lot of other support in that area as well.
Mm-hmm.
Not just Pop Hill. There was a lot of refugee problem there because that's where the war was occurring
mm-hmm.
more in earnest than elsewhere. And Air America was heavily involved in that area as well.
And the refugee were all Hmong?
Well, I've worked with both.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. In fact, in Ban Hoi Sai, we worked with the Yao, Y-A-O.
Right, okay.
And when I was in Ban Hoi Sai, we worked with, I can't remember the name of the people. But anyhow, it was a different tribal group.
Uh-huh.
They were very different. I mean, they lived in communal housing.
Ooh.
One big long barracks.
Right, yeah.
Not individual huts. Yeah.
Not even divided up for families?
Maybe screened with a little bamboo mat or something.
Oh, okay. Yeah, but nothing like a wall.
No, not serious wall. No.
Not serious wall, just a serious blanket or something like that.
They were very good people to work with. Very favorable. When I think of their name, I'll introduce them.
Okay.
Oh, there was another group up there. This will interest you, maybe as a historian. One day I'm on this road that we opened up, or helped open up, with my teeth, and here on foot comes an American, at least a foreigner, turned out to be an American. Who are you? He was Dr. somebody from Yale University. Wow, what are you doing here, man? Well, I'm here to study this certain tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm sorry, I can't remember their name. It's been too long, the name of the tribe.
Yeah.
But the tribe was dying. Mm-hmm. And he was down to like one village. And they made their income by the knowledge of how to take bamboo and turn it into paper to wrap opium in. That was their identifying trait, or mode of operation. So anyhow, just for the sake of history, I'm mentioning it, that there was a tribe that all they did was make paper for the opium runners.
Oh, jeez.
And Dr. Somebody was studying them. Now, opium, watch out for opium, man. Look the other way when you come to see that.
What do
you mean? Serious business. They'll shoot you over that.
Oh, the business of it, not the ingesting of it.
No. Don't mess with the opium people. They're serious. They carry big guns. One day I was on the same trail and came around the corner with my Jeep. Now, this big animal's in front of me. It was a mule. I mean, this mule's big, bigger than a horse. Big. Several, whole line of them. Uh-oh.
Stumbled you came on a mule train, huh?
Yeah, I sure did. I didn't see anything. I just looked the other way. They went past me.
Uh-huh.
And I never told anybody then. I mean, I can tell now. It wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
I didn't say anything. They're all carrying guns. Now that was controlled. See, this is near the Golden Triangle.
Mm-hmm.
And since the number of years have passed and there's very slight chance this could ever get back to where it would hurt, I learned where they were going. They were going to the airfield at Bonhoeffsi, that's where our house was. At the end of the airfield, there was this enclosed area with a lot of barbed wire. I never viewed it too closely, but I know it was that often had army people around it.
Mm-hmm.
Armed, and that was the warehouse. And the Lao army would fly in their airplanes and pick up opium.
And take it out.
A fact you would never want to mention back then.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I never did.
No, not if you had to live up there just across the airstrip from them. they might really get pretty pissed off at you. Yeah.
Now, it turned, I suppose it doesn't matter anymore. It turned out where I stayed in Bonhoeffsi, I was IBS.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an ex-IBSer that stayed there too.
Oh, in your same house.
Yep, Dr. Bill Taylor. And unknown to naive Gus, he worked for the CIA. He never told me, I never asked him.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I moved in.
He
pretended to be my boss. You know, they like, once every 2 months he might say, Gus, have you been doing anything recently?
Uh-huh.
And I'd say, well, you know, up the river we got a few schools are being built. couple of wells here and there, and this and that. He leave me alone, I left him alone. Turned out he was CIA, and the idea, he had been IDS, which is why I didn't know the difference. And he was being employed to develop the Hill Tribe medical facilities. And he would train medics, and then he'd make sure that they had medicine and go to the remote areas and set up dispensaries and stuff like that.
That's what he was doing?
Yeah. No, he wasn't a shooter. They had them there that were shooters.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't do it, so. At least not that I know of.
Yeah. So his was more on the medical.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it was a couple of years after I left there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the eight people in contact told me that he worked for the CIA. I didn't even know it until then.
Yeah.
There's another group that needs a little help, CIA. Very few well speakers, very, very few.
Did Taylor speak?
Yeah. Yep.
Uh-huh.
I knew of one other, and I mean, I'm talking 12 years over there. I knew of two.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there were more that could speak, but I didn't meet them.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very bad weakness. Especially in their trade.
Yeah, of all things, you would expect, you know, maybe AID guys.
They duck their coming, you know. You ought to be able to tell somebody that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Better run.
Yeah, all sorts of really important life-saving things they should be able to say in the language.
Yes.
Yeah. To know that, yeah, enemy is here.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah.
But to know where the enemy was often very difficult. It was like a war of rumors.
Mm-hmm.
If the other guy could get a rumor up that had more troops, then they won that day's battle. I'll give you an example. I don't remember if I was... No, I guess I worked for eight at the time I did this one.
Mm-hmm.
This was the worst assignment I ever had. Our American airplanes bombed a village by mistake. They were targeting a bridge and they missed it by 100 kilometers.
Jeez.
And fortunately, when the bombs dropped, the people were at the village market. It was early in the morning.
Uh-huh.
And so there were a few casualties among people. I'm sure some were injured, but I don't think there was a lot of fatalities. But the end result was there were two bombs that went in the ground that never exploded.
Uh-huh.
These bombs had a time to light fuse, and when they hit the ground, they broke a vial of acid that would eat through a string that would
eventually,
So when the curious people came back to look at this big hole in the ground, kaboom. So here we are with two bombs in the ground and 33 houses destroyed. And I drew the short straw, and I was sent there to get the houses rebuilt. Now, of course, I was given a team of carpenters, a couple of trucks, some money to buy some lumber. Nobody gave me a place to sleep, and no Lao gave me a good place to sleep either. Those people were so pissed off, they wouldn't even talk to me.
No kidding.
And I told you earlier, if you gave me 3 minutes, I could make a friend with any Lao.
Right.
I couldn't in Mont Blanc.
Mm-hmm.
I never did. Those people were real unhappy.
No kidding.
Well, we also had a TACAN station there. Enough years ago by, we could spill some of the beans. The TACAN station is a navigational device that leads the airplanes to Vietnam from Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a radar kind of installation. And it requires people to maintain it, to run a generator and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So the American Army had people.
Even in the village that was hit?
Well, the airstrip that they stayed at was like a quarter of a mile out.
Okay, so they were real close though.
Yes. And it was very tempting to go and work and to sleep and eat with those fellas. Although they wouldn't have been my favorite companions. They sure were nicer. At least they spoke.
Yeah, right.
But I was scared. I wouldn't go sleep there. Because I was worried that they were going to get attacked.
Mm-hmm.
And this is the story I'm telling you, is leading up to, you never know where the enemy is. It got so hairy, the village mayor left, the school teacher left, the Lao colonel left, chief of police left. I was the only target besides the guys at the airport. So,
ooh, what do you mean we, white man? Yeah, you're
so
the only one there.
I sent a cryptic message to my local aid support person in Savannah Kent and said, please advise me about the security here, if you know anything at all.
Uh-huh.
And a helicopter came the next morning, and Lieutenant Colonel Lauren Hafner got up, my old buddy from Bon Huisot, forward area man.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, spiffed up, rolled up sleeves. Oh, man. He says, what's this, Gus? We got problems here. He says, let's assemble out at the airport at 0800, or whatever they say. So all these Americans that were at the airport, now I'm talking just a handful, maybe five Americans and five Filipino,
mm-hmm.
running this device. So he corrals us all into this little shack and says, I'm Lieutenant Colonel Hafner of the U.S. Army and this and that, Special Ambassador to the United States, blah, 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 blah. I'm here to brief you on the security situation here. Now there's this, that. There is an enemy somewhere north of here. We don't know how many. We don't know how well armed they are. And we really don't know their intentions. But you're safe. We don't know anything about them, but you're safe.
Yeah. Such a reassurance. Thank you, sir.
Yes, Gus, you have a question. Yes, sir. If they decided they wanted to attack us, by chance, what would our actions be, sir? Long silence. Well, there's an army encampment here at the airport. They'll protect you. Lieutenant Colonel Hafner, sir. Have you seen this encampment? Would you like to come with me to the encampment? I'm telling you, there was like five soldiers with their wives and 10 kids each and pigs and chickens.
Uh-huh.
And the fort, well, the so-called fort, was a couple of ditches in the ground. The wood was so rotten that the earth was falling in, you know? I mean, this... Hey, you would go to this fort just so you wouldn't have something fall on you, you know? Much less to be protection against, like, a mortar or something. So he viewed this thing and he turned around and he says, well, on second thought, I wouldn't retire.
I'd retire anywhere else as
well
as I could.
He said, no, he ended up with a plan. We devised a plan on the spot, and that was to take your radio and a
uh-huh.
canteen of water and go south on the river. They were trying to bomb a bridge when they
mm-hmm.
missed. So go south on that river. Eventually a helicopter will come along and pick you up.
Uh-huh.
Oh, great. Oh, our problems are solved. Lieutenant Colonel, would you now care to go back to Savannah Kent? We have a Jeep waiting for you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, he says, I'm not driving on that road. It's the road I'm expected to go on daily, you know.
Yeah.
I'm not driving on that road. You'll have to call me an airplane. So, the security aspect of life in Laos was very fragile. And all I can say is, well, I'm speaking more now, I think, from my time as aide, because when I worked for aide, I had a number of local employees.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people had to run bulldozers and be surveyors.
Right. With all that stuff, yeah.
I mean, there were times when there were 200 or 300 people that worked for me.
Oh, sure.
Well, all I can say is never do anything to make them unhappy with you. I mean, real unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're your lifeline. If something's going to happen, you want them to be there to tell you to get out of the way. So,
because they will know that
they're going to hear it long before you hear it.
Yeah.
Look, I can give you a perfect example. On this road job that we talked about, building the road up to Longchamp.
Yeah, the big one. For the
there was an American, his name is George McClatchy. My first view of George McClatchy as I arrived on the road job, I'm in a Jeep and I'm driving out the road to find him.
Uh-huh.
And up in front of me, some distance, there's a figure reaching up into a road grader and grabbing a person and pulling them out and throwing them onto the ground. That's George McClatchy treating his Lao crew fairly.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah, oh, yeah. This guy had a temper so short. And he's hollering to the guy, I can teach a monkey to drive this thing better than you. Get out of my way.
Thank goodness the Lao probably didn't know English well enough.
No, but they know the word goddamn.
Would they know the word monkey?
No.
Good.
But goddamn is the kiss of death. You could be talking to another American just in a regular conversation and use the word goddamn and everything around you comes to a dead halt.
Really?
Boom.
Wow.
They know it's, I don't know what they think it means or but man, that word is magic.
Well,
so anyhow, you don't use the word goddamn too often when you're there. And you don't pull people out of. So what happens to George McClatchy?
Well, they should never do that. I mean, even he wouldn't do that if he was back here in the States.
No, but I'm using this as an example of how not to get your crew friendly with you.
Yeah, right.
And what the consequence is.
Oh, I know
and
that.
The consequence
just
is
that
George
McClatchy was such an
ass. Can't walk anymore.
Uh-huh. What happened to him?
George
Justice, huh?
No. About 1 week after this, uh-huh. The whole crew, and I'm talking 300 or 400 men, the whole camp went on strike.
Mm-hmm.
And they wouldn't go to work until McClatchy was removed. And my stupid boss from Vientiane, who I otherwise would say I admired, came and backed up Mr. McClatchy. And I was the interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
And I was the one that told the 400 assembled strikers that Mr. McClatchy would be their boss.
Uh-huh.
I didn't draw any applause at all. I don't know if they were blamed. I don't think they blamed me. No, if they'd blamed me, I'd be where he is now. Within a week, Mr. McClatchy's truck was ambushed by the Pat Bedlow. Things were so hot for him in camp, he couldn't stay there overnight. So he commuted to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they set up an ambush. They killed two people in the back of the truck. It was a B-40 rocket. It went diagonally through the truck.
Mm-hmm.
And it physically killed the people. It never blew up.
You mean it went through them?
It was such close range, right? Such close range that it didn't detonate. At least this is what I was told.
Uh-huh.
And it went under, it came in from the back and went under the calf of his leg and out the door. He had a bodyguard with him as the truck pulled over to the side of the road and fled. And McClatchy, with his leg shot off, not off, but mangled,
yeah,
crawled into the jungle and waited for them to come finish him off. And they never came. And about an hour later, he crawled back out of the jungle alongside this road. Somebody on a bicycle saw him and reported it.
Uh-huh.
And they came in, you know, the military came and picked him up. Took him away. Shot. So, Lao justice.
Yeah, yeah. Clearly he was set up by
Oh, sure.
By the workers.
Oh, but they freely admitted it. Well, then we fixed him.
Even
we fixed him, and Mr. Carlson, you want to screw with us? We'll fix you. We know who's in charge here.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was whoever got more guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, very, very touchy. Very touchy.
Well, my impression when you told me, you know, he's pulling guys off and throwing them on the ground. I mean, you know, if he would have tried that on a construction site here,
he'd get shot too.
Something else might have happened.
Yeah.
You know, he'd probably, he's going to go over there as the big white man and just order the natives around.
Yeah.
I mean, that strikes me as just being racist. That's about it.
It was. Yeah. Well, clearly was. Well, no doubt about it. I protested to my boss vigorously.
Mm-hmm.
My ankle was, I don't want to be in the same basket with this guy.
Right, right.
Because but you see, this goes back to what I said before. Americans aren't very good at this. Because my boss didn't get my point of view either.
Mm-hmm.
He came up and supported the fight. This is my man, George. Well, he was playing to the bar crowd back in Vincennes.
Mm-hmm.
Being the boss that stands behind his men.
Did he get the point after the guy was mangled?
Who knows?
Okay. I thought maybe you had some dealings with him and he kind of like indicated to you that he's going to figure it out.
I don't think
now.
He would have ever said anything to me.
Well, not said,
no.
Indicated.
Well, he indicated that I was okay. I kept working for him.
Uh-huh.
But he never indicated that George wasn't okay either.
That wasn't okay either, yeah. That. Well, maybe there's something here I didn't realize before. Yeah.
Yes. Well, George ended up on a pig farm in New Guinea.
Mm-hmm.
He went on vacation. He had a Cambodian wife and about 7 kids. He went on vacation. And they got to, I can't think, Guam.
Mm-hmm.
They got to Guam and their airplane had mechanical trouble and they had to stay overnight. Unplanned. He was going to go back to New Guinea because that's where he fought in World War II. Yeah, that's it.
Mm-hmm.
So on his way, he got stuck in Guam. And a taxi driver on the way into the hotel got talking to him and told him that he really ought to consider Guam. Guam mm-hmm. was a good place. And it is. He had people that had land for sale.
Mm-hmm.
So George agreed the next day to go with the taxi driver to go see it. Set up his pig farm in Guam. That's the last I heard. He's in Guam, pig farm.
Well, if it'll work,
yeah.
You know. When I read over your thing, I wrote out a couple of
sure.
couple of questions here.
Okay.
Some of them you've already covered.
I bet.
That just sort of naturally happens. I mean, because I was going through, say, I asked when you arrived in 63. Uh-huh. But one thing, it gets to the political stuff. I mean, a lot of the things you've been talking about have been political sense.
Mm-hmm.
But was there a lot of spillover from the political situation in Vietnam? I'm thinking particularly of the assassination of Diem in 63 and deterioration of the situation there that seemed to affect what was going on in Laos.
Not specifically.
Okay.
Let's see. I always thought, I think, you know, even our government thought of Laos as a sideshow.
Mm-hmm.
Military sideshow. Important because if the United States side of things controlled Laos, then that cut off the communist support from there.
Mm-hmm.
It also diminished the possibility of Thailand being infiltrated more than it was. Thailand always cried big problem, but I never saw a big problem in Thailand. I mean, they make a lot of smoke about it, fighting communists and all that. But my opinion is the communists never got a real strong foothold in Thailand. Thailand means free, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, man, they practice it, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they quite... a lot of pride in the Thai people. And that's positive and negative.
Oh, yeah, it can be, yeah.
Their arrogance as well as... So, Laos depended on Vietnam not to be communist, or Laos would fall, which
right,
happened.
Yeah.
But any events in Vietnam, like let's say when we decide we're going to bomb Cambodia, there isn't all of a sudden a big change in everything we're doing in Laos. Life just went on regular again.
Okay.
Or any other, if you can, you know, put your finger on any other political turning point in Vietnam, I bet I could say, well, in Laos we learned about it either by the Voice of America, if we wanted to know about it right away,
right,
or in Newsweek the next. It didn't, at least at the level I worked at, our programs did.
There was something here that that I wrote.
Mm-hmm.
When you were traveling around, or at least going from one assignment to another and working out the clusters with the various villages, how would you make your initial contact in a village? You know, the process of approaching these villagers with, you know, your questions and proposals and such. Do you know what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, but the reason I'm hesitating is that there's no single answer.
Oh.
In other words, there wasn't a specific policy.
Okay. Or procedure that you found to be most effective. Or not effective, but let's say...
not effective, so...
Okay.
Well, even if I named what the procedure was, I'd probably never practice it exactly the way it would come out.
Okay.
But the idea, I guess, again, is if you can speak the language and you can send word ahead that you're coming and that you're peaceful.
Right.
And interested in what their problems and troubles are on the village level. See if you can get a Lao official to come with you to lend a little legitimacy, not only to you, but to him.
What kind of official would you most often bring?
Well, the Lao government, if you were going to a refugee village, they have
someone
a refugee
office.
Official.
Uh-huh, okay.
If you're doing an agricultural program, they have what they call an agricultural person.
Yeah, yeah.
Like in Ban Hoi Sai, where I did most of the work by myself, when I made these trips up the river weekly, or the week trip up the river,
mm-hmm.
I every time that I can, I mean, probably didn't happen every time, but it was my intention that every time I went, the refugee man would be with me, the Lao
right.
official.
Right.
Because there were no other Americans. The Lao official who was the refugee, the head of the school system, I can remember the governor of the province going with us, but not every single trip.
Okay.
But the idea was that we were together in this.
Mm-hmm.
The program wouldn't work unless the Lao government also was associated with. of course, the idea was to get the village people to begin to have some faith in their own government, because it really was a government that was imposed on them.
Yeah.
There was democracy in its purest form at the village level, but as soon as you start to talk districts, somebody was appointed by whoever happened to be in power in the big city.
Mm-hmm.
So, depending on the nature of that person, you know, it depended on how he treated those people. If you could talk that individual and joining you, that not only beneficial to you, but to him as well, and, you know, to try the programs going ahead. So, yeah, if I went the first time, I try to have the appropriate Lao officials with me. I never really counted on them to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't well trained, not always very dedicated. In fact, I could state to you the fact of life, and that is, if you were a policeman or an army official, the idea was to see how many items you could get the Americans to give you so that you could then sell them somewhere. I had a classic case. The American government, they had a thing called RO, Requirements Office, which was really the American military dressed up as civilians passing out goods. Mm-hmm. You call it Just Mag?
Yeah, in the Philippines it was called the Joint U.S. Military Assistance
Group. Same group here.
Yeah.
This case I'm thinking of is so classic. They gave the Lao Army in Pakse a road grader, among other, but I'm using the road grader because I happen to know this one case very well.
Yeah.
To maintain the airport.
Mm-hmm.
Then they decided that they had to build a place to store the explosive items, whatever, ordnance or whatever you call it. So they had to have a construction. So this RO group hired a contractor from Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
But this man lacked a road grader.
Mm-hmm.
So he went to the Lao Army and they rented it to him. So here we got the Americans paying the contractor to do the job using a road grader that he has to pay off the Lao Army who had just been given the road grader. Well, in other words, the corruption not only was there, it was blatant.
Mm-hmm.
As the public works person, I brought this to the attention of RO, in case they didn't know that's what was happening.
Uh-huh.
At the road grader, the army was now being charged to them to build the ordnance depot for the same army. Oh, yeah, so what, Gus? Happens all the time. Yeah. Small potatoes.
So they didn't care?
No. It's just the way things work.
Had they known before you called them?
Probably not that specific instance.
Uh-huh. But it wasn't anything that fazed them at all.
Well, that's the way the world worked for them.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually, that's a hopeless case. There wasn't, I'd say basically there wouldn't be anything anybody in the world could have done to make the Lao Army a more effective force. It just wasn't in the cards. The leaders were in it for the graft and the prestige of the position, you know, being a big man in town. And the poor little foot soldier's in it because he has no education and no job, and it's the only way that he can get 3 meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
And his entire focus is on making sure he isn't there when anybody starts to shoot him. Very, very ineffective fighting force, indeed. I don't think anybody could have helped him out very much.
Hmm. And certainly the Pathet Lao were an effective force, by comparison, anyway.
Well, I think they were more, you know, sincerely motivated, where I'm trying to say that ours weren't.
Okay.
Now, whether they the Pathet Lao, I have one or two cases where I witnessed their handiwork, were pretty crude. They tried to blow up a bridge that we built in a very, very crude, unprofessional manner. I mean, you know, all they did was blow the paint off. You know, I mean, they didn't put the charges where you should.
They were still learning.
In other words, yeah, they're also untrained. We had a case where they took over a village where we had been set up, and we had a warehouse, and in the warehouse we had, among other things, paint.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got there, the paint was strewn all over the walls. When we got back, you know, and we were able to take it back.
Uh-huh.
And so we're talking to the Lao officials about, you know, why did they do that? Oh, they tried to drink it, and it didn't taste good, and they got mad and threw it against the wall.
Oh, no.
So they might have been more dedicated, but they, you know, there was often cases where they showed definite signs of weakness.
Yeah, I guess they had the success they did mostly because the Vietnamese were helping them out and giving them directions.
I think so, yeah. But you see, they were driven. They, you know, they had a sincere beef. So the motivation was there. I think they often weren't well supplied.
Mm-hmm. But they were associated with the one prince.
Yeah.
So was it more of a factional thing?
I think it was upper class, lower class. I think that prince had popular support.
Okay.
Savonawa. And the people. See, I'm guessing now, so it's really should be discounted.
Okay.
But my impression would be, if he had fled into the jungle and not had popular support, he would have languished.
Right.
But he didn't languish.
And it wasn't just
they
because
put up a fight. I mean, they killed people.
Yeah, but and it wasn't just because he had North Vietnamese support.
No, if he didn't have support from the grassroots, he couldn't survive.
Even with Hanoi's help.
Right. Oh, no, Vietnamese are not liked by Lao.
Oh, really? Okay.
No. Vietnamese aren't liked by anybody.
Well, I knew how much the Cambodians hate them. I wasn't sure how much the hatred of the Lao was.
Well, I don't think the Lao, given recent history with the Vietnamese controlling Cambodia, I think the bitterness among Cambodians is much more intense today, than it would be for our average Lao, who really haven't endured the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese, you know, never showed up in force in Laos and ran things.
Of course, the Lao never had a Pol Pot either.
Oh, thank God.
Yeah, thank God is right.
So. Well, oh boy, never knew where they were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
I was told one time, I came back to a crew after about 2 weeks. I came back to give them their monthly pay and see what supplies they needed and stuff. And I went to this site by Jeep. And when I drove in, they literally came up and pinched me.
The Pathet Lao?
No, my crew.
Oh, okay.
The
All
locals
right.
that
All right.
were hired by pinching my arm like that.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you guys doing? Oh, is that you, boss? Is that you?
They
thought I was dead. They were feeling you to make sure that you were real.
Because the last time I had visited, I drove away, the enemy was there. And they knew I'd been captured.
Because the timing was so close, yeah. You're driving off in their arrival. How could they have missed you?
I didn't know anything about it. Wow. There was no security meeting or briefing or any indication that there was any trouble in that area whatsoever.
So yeah. A few more minutes of lingering could have been your last.
Yeah. Unless I could have talked my way out of it.
It would have been tough.
It would sure would have put my theory to a test, huh?
About being with a guy for 3 minutes.
Yeah. Well, we had the terrible story one day up in Huisai where I was in northern Laos. We were the only Americans, so when the Air America people came to work overnight, in other words, an airplane would be assigned to work there.
Right.
And the pilot would have to stay overnight. So he'd stay with us. So we'd see him every morning, you know, get a coffee and stuff before he left. So this guy hopped in his airplane that morning. His assignment was to make a drop, which means to drop rice. Make a rice drop at a certain village, and there was a signal to make sure that village was in our control. The army was on every day the signals changed, like to make the signal P or the signal X or
the normal or sort three, of thing, like
three
the password
puffs of
that,
smoke or whatever.
Yeah, the password that.
So he flew to this place, and he called down and told them to put out the signal, and they did. So he landed. I don't know why, but he landed. And they took they unloaded the airplane. And he went back. Make his second trip. The second trip, he landed and was captured.
It was in the last. Between that time?
30 minutes.
30 minutes.
The last they saw of him is aerial photographs in handcuffs or rope or whatever, being led by a string to Vietnam.
Was he one of the
airmen?
POWs that came back after.
I don't know. I didn't keep track of the names. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know his name. We had breakfast with us that day.
Yeah. And then captured by lunch.
I have seen the way they treat people. And you would not want to be a prisoner.
Mm-hmm.
No. They had a hideous display in Pak Sai, in front of the army compound. A little wire cage. Not a wire cage, a little barbed wire cage. Too short for a man to stretch out full, and too low for a man to sit up. And that prisoners kept in there day and night, day and night, day and night. Rain, sun, whatever. Terrible. Treat them like less than you treat a dog. It's terrible. We want to be captured.
Take the pill instead, huh?
Well, put up a fight.
Yeah, at least. At least.
Don't go docilely.
Yeah. When you were with AID later, did you have any IVS assigned with you?
Well, of course, when I was with AID, I went through a lot of assignments, so that's why I got to search my mind. I certainly saw IBS people in the field, though.
Right, right.
Because I basically stayed in the field all the time. As I told you before, among the 30 people in the Public Works Division of AID, there were four of us that were able to speak the language so that we could be effective. So we were used almost exclusively.
And three out of the four were ex-IBS?
Yeah.
So all the other 26
well, we
couldn't even function.
We Well, they could function.
Well, they could function, but with limited...
They were very good in air-conditioned rooms.
Yeah.
No, that's not fair. There were some that were hardy fellows who had an interpreter and would do their week stint on some job somewhere.
Uh-huh.
And when the week was up, you know, they'd fly back to Denton and their family and recuperate.
Yeah. Well, if they had their family with them, I'm sure they'd want to see the family for a bit.
Well, while they're gone, what happens? There's 200 men with how many drums of gasoline and how many... Well, it disappears, man.
Mm-hmm.
You got it. You can't do it by remote control. You got to be there. You got to speak. And you got to lead them.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be in charge. You can't be a sometimes boss. You got to see. We're set up wrong. They sent the wrong people. Should have had more people that could speak.
Or would want to learn.
Or, yeah, willing to learn. Right? Yeah. Now, the number of these fellows I'm referring to, you know, I worked shoulder to shoulder with them. They were there year after year. They never learned to speak. Never did.
Mm-hmm.
Don't know why. Must have been miserable life. Not to understand what's going around. What's happening around you.
So it was one of the things that I got strongest out of your survey form that you mailed back to us, saying so emphatically that if you don't know the language, don't even bother. Don't even bother to go.
Well, I mean, if you had to, I'll give them effectiveness 10%, and
right.
I'll give the four of us effectiveness 80.
Mm-hmm.
Just to throw out some numbers.
Just, yeah.
Quite frankly, and I even knew it when it was happening, it isn't like I'm making it up 20 years later. We knew we were in charge. We knew we could get away with a lot of stuff. Because we knew that the American government needed us.
You four of you.
I don't think anybody abused it.
Uh-huh.
But we all knew it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll have to, I can only speak for myself.
Yeah.
But that's such a powerful, whatever you want to call it, that I wasn't reluctant about speaking my mind whenever I wanted to.
Yeah, right. With the medicines and the
whatever it is,
in the hospital or whatever.
I just let the chips fall.
Mm-hmm.
I got burned, you know. I mean, sure. But they took some pot shots at me. I had some. Had some rough time. I'll tell you what happened one time. They give you this is very instructive the way the American government works. And I'm sure this happens right up to the President of the United States. Every employee is rated yearly.
Yep.
You know this? You're rated by your immediate superior, and then his report is reviewed by one of his superiors.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy Carlson was causing one hell of a fuss. Well, I was very angry at one point. This place where we had to go by boat to support remember I told you we had to call an airplane?
To pick you up. Yeah. Well, you were stuck in the Mekong.
It was a very, very dangerous place to be.
Uh-huh.
And we were trying to do these four irrigation programs.
Uh-huh.
Where the heavy equipment built irrigation ditches so they could raise the miracle rice. Well, we had a critical piece of equipment lose its engine.
Uh-huh.
And without that piece of equipment, all the other pieces were tied up because it did a critical.
It's like an assembly line.
Well, to make a long story short, I waited 30 days for that engine to be replaced.
And nothing else is happening.
It didn't come. So I finally ended up. I have a friend that was an IBSer that was at work in the chief emissions office, the head of the A program.
So
I called up Phil Bushler and I said, Phil, I'm at the end of my string here. He knew me quite well.
Uh-huh.
We were friends. I'm at the end of my string and I need your help. Please get me an engine for this bulldozer and I need it now. and I'm not getting any support from my boss.
Uh-huh.
And so Phil went out and got the, and put it on an airplane and sent it to him. My boss went ballistic.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I got the engine, I neatly pointed out how easy it was for somebody motivated to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were asking me to put my life on the line every day going up and down the river.
Uh-huh.
And they wouldn't send me a goddamn bulldozer engine. And I don't like this.
Yeah.
So they made life very difficult for me when they wrote up this report.
Mm-hmm.
And they
made, you're uncooperative and everything.
Yes. Oh yeah. Oh, this story gets pretty good because it went pretty deep. And the man that wrote the report had never ever come to any area that I worked in.
Uh-huh.
He had never left the office in Vientiane. And the man that reviewed it had never,
mm-hmm.
ever. And when I got my notice that I was in the, what they do is if you're in the bottom 10% of your classified group, I think I was called an engineer's aide or whatever. If you're in the bottom 10% of this rated group,
mm-hmm.
you're on automatic probation. Yeah, probation would be a good word. And if it happens again the second year, you're fired.
Mm-hmm.
So I was put in this group.
Mm-hmm.
And I was called into Vientiane to be told this. So I walked into the personnel's office, and Mr. Carr, who was the head of personnel, and says, Mr. Carlson, have you seen this report? Which I was, legally, I have to countersign it. I said, what report? He said, this report right here, your personnel report. I said, no, I haven't seen that. He says, well, you signed it. I says, I did not. Somebody counterfeit my name.
Uh-huh.
He says, well, that's your claim, or some words to that effect. I said, well, I could tell you about the report if I could read it, sir. I could respond to your question that I'd seen it.
Uh-huh.
Let me see it, please. And it had numerous false statements in it.
Uh-huh.
And I said, this report is false.
Uh-huh.
Whoever wrote it is telling lies, sir.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm perfectly happy to back up anything I'm saying. All you've got to do is send somebody back down to Savannah Camp. That's where I was working at.
Uh-huh.
And you circulate this report and you see if they agree that these are the things I do. And sure enough, they did. And
they sure, did.
And sure enough.
Was this personnel guy did this on his own?
He happened to be friendly.
With you?
No, he didn't know me from Adam.
Oh, okay.
He happened to be friendly with the what they call, I forget what they call him, the area coordinator, the man that ran, the American that ran that area.
Uh-huh.
Like a mini ambassador for Savannah province. Yeah. Or whatever. Well, they were buddies.
Uh-huh.
Turned out, I didn't know it. So he sent the Mr. Stone the report. Mr. Stone went ballistic.
Yeah, yeah.
This guy Carlson's doing a hell of a job. Who the hell's this other guy that never showed up down here writing up these things that aren't true?
Uh-huh.
They fired the guy.
They fired him?
Yes, sir. In the end, that guy got nailed.
Bam.
Go home, boy.
For trying this kind of stuff.
Good. Mr. William Mackey.
Well, I'm glad that they got him. Well, that restores a little bit of faith, you know, not much. You're still giving me a lot of
ammunition. I was on one goddamn thin string for a long time, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
I was like disowned.
Because of that report?
Yes, sir. I couldn't.
Even after it was flipped over?
Oh, no, no. After it was proven out, then I was a hero.
Then you were
a
hero. Okay.
You're right.
All your friends,
oh, yeah,
all the friends that forgot about you for a while suddenly remembered.
Oh,
you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was back on track.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
But I went through that kind of thing quite often. I was a little quick on the trigger. I know we were building a dam one time. We were building a dam, and the bulldozer operator got off the bulldozer because it overheated. And
uh-huh.
he called for the kid that was helping him to bring a bucket of water. When the kid bringing a bucket of water jumped up on the bulldozer, rolled back over it.
Ooh.
Caught him under the track and killed him.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, what happens in a case like that? You don't believe me that the Lao police are corrupt. The Lao police show up And they handcuffed the bulldozer operator and take him to jail.
Uh-huh.
I don't know what. I'm saying that the bulldozer was instructed to run over this kid. I mean, the operator was in equal danger. He was up on the hood trying to get the water pail from the kid.
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, to make a long story short, to get him out of jail, everybody in the camp contributed money.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the sum, but it was something like $400 in a lot of money. That got him out of jail.
Uh-huh.
Now, this guy's our only bulldozer operator of this big equipment that's building this thing. The next day, who shows up? Well, police.
Mm-hmm.
Put him in handcuffs again, leave him off the show.
Well, maybe there's some more money to ask for.
Another 400.
Yes.
Okay, collection's taken, all the men contribute, get Conti back out of jail, get the bulldozer to run again, start the project to help the Lao people again. What happens on the third day?
Provincial police.
Here they come. But this time, the American that couldn't speak Lao wasn't there.
That could not speak Lao.
That's right. Mr. George Wagner, for history's sake.
Okay.
Mr. George Wagner wasn't there to kowtow to the bastards, but I was there.
Uh-huh.
So when that guy came out there to get him again, I asked him, well, they got to take him back to jail. I said, this man's not going to jail.
Uh-huh.
They said, yes, he is. And I stepped in between him and between the guy they were trying to get and the gun.
Uh-huh.
I says, well, if you shoot him, you're going to go through me first.
Uh-huh.
Oh, boy. Well, that poor little kid with a gun never...
Bargained on this.
No, never had anything this big in front of him before. He didn't know what to do.
Oh, yeah, he was probably needing new underwear about that.
So I told his boss, who's still sitting there in the Jeep, waiting for his... to tell the kid to put the gun down. But he's not going to get anywhere with the gun. And he said, he'll put the gun down if you step back. And I says, okay, I'll step back. So... long story short, they take him to jail again. But Gus is declared persona non grata by the Lao government.
Uh-huh.
For interfering with the Lao police. And he is given a special airplane ride back to the capital city.
Mm-hmm.
Without all his belongings.
Mm-hmm.
And he is told that he is under investigation